It's Shabbat Chayei Sarah. It is the life of Sarah, and our portion this morning, as we said there, was from Bereshit, Genesis 23:1-16. From the Haftarah, it was from 1 Kings 1:15-31. And from the Messianic writings, the parable of the so-called Good Samaritan, and that was from the Besorah, the Good News according to Lucas, and that was chapter 10:25-37. Fascinating parable. More about that in a moment. But first of all, in this portion, we see the end of our first matriarch's life. And as Lenka was preaching last week, if you haven't heard the sermon, it's recorded for all you on Facebook there. You can go back to last week's and have a look at the service and hear the message again. What a challenging, enigmatic figure she is. Why did she die in Hebron, apparently so far from her family? What was she doing? What was happening in her life? And we know, of course, as we were hearing last week, so much of this is filled out, and there's so many questions around all of this. And yet, while the portion's named after her, it is quite intriguing that the story rapidly moves on. And immediately our attention is diverted in the next chapter to another servant of the Lord. Not Sarah this time, but, well, we don't really know his name, do we? Well, we do know his name. Tradition has given his name, and we don't have a problem with the traditions around this of what this man's name is, but I'm not going to name him for you this morning. If you want to know, go back to previous year's sermons or speak to me after the service. I want to leave him today as the unnamed servant of the Lord. He's an interesting chap, this one. His obedience frames the next steps of the narrative. I'm going to say his obedience frames it, because actually it is way more than just his obedience. His obedience is the end product for this unnamed servant of some qualities in his life which are really, really important. You see, Abraham knows this servant really, really well. And he said, look, we need a wife for my son. What are we going to do? And it says to this unnamed servant, who's not listed, name not listed here for us, speaks to this servant and sends him away. And on one level we can look at this and just say, yes, this servant just did as his master told him to do. No. It was way more than that. It was way more than that. This was a man who was being sent out by Abraham, go back to his family to find a wife for his son. This is not just an act of obedience that we see going on here. This is something way, way bigger than this. Imagine if it's one of the people in the congregation here and someone comes up to you and says, you know, so and so, I want you to go and do X for me. And you send that person off and they're going down to London or New York or they're going to Israel or wherever it may be to find a husband or a wife for your child, or maybe even something really, really important on an equal level. Who knows what it may be? Once that servant is out of your sight, who knows what is going to happen? You can't see, can you? Abraham couldn't see what that servant was up to. Maybe he slipped down the road to quit Mackie D or something. You know, who knows? Right, Abraham can't see, he's not aware of what's going on. We suddenly discover there's a lot more happening with this servant, because he's unnamed for a reason. He's unnamed because narcissism, even then, wasn't a quality deemed to be meritorious. He's unnamed because he was obedient, because he was humble, he was able to listen to his master and go off and do as he was instructed to do. But from the other side of that coin, Abraham had enormous trust in this man. This is a major decision for his son. The woman he was going to marry, the woman they wouldn't even see until they got back and this unnamed servant brought her. How could Abraham know what this servant would look for? How could he know when this servant was looking at the women in the family there, that this walk into whatever situation he was going to walk into, he was trusting the unnamed servant at that point to decide and choose a wife for his son? It's incredible when you think about it. Incredible because it shows you not just the trust that Abraham had in this man, but the faithfulness in this man to his master, Abraham, and his desire to absolutely do the total best that he could do for his master's son. And suddenly you begin to realize, this isn't about obedience. It really isn't about obedience. That's a superficial thing. And as always, when we're looking at the scriptures, always when we're looking at passages, you've got to go deeper than the surface to really understand what is going on here. Because, you know, it's the name is irrelevant because it's not on who he was, but the spiritual qualities of this man's life of service that really mattered and counted. See, the problem is in our day and age, it's all about who you are. Everyone has an Insta account, everyone is on Facebook, everyone is loading photos 15, 30 a day. They only have to burp when they take a photo and it's on Instagram. And a million people are commenting on it. This is the spirit of our age. It's all about who we are. We talk about on Instagram, just reading the other day about these so-called influencers on Instagram. Thinking like, why? What? They're paid just to influence people. Their name carries value. It has currency. It's all about who you are. Not so in the kingdom. In the kingdom, it's not about who you are. It's not about your name. It's not about the celebrity cult. It's not about having your name and everything up in lights. In the scriptures, it is about the spiritual qualities of your life. Well before any mitzvot could define a righteous lifestyle, and the rare examples of the revelation, Noah's clean animals and so on, notwithstanding, what we've got in the narrative that we read through history here are what you could describe as true, humanly real acts of righteousness and goodness, the spiritual qualities within a person when you look at their lifestyle hallmarked by the living presence of God. Shall we say the difference God makes in people's lives if we choose to let him reign in us? Abraham did. Abraham chose to do what God asked him to do, but it wasn't just because he was an obedient man. You know, people who are compliant by nature are obedient. It says nothing about the quality of their life. It says nothing about the quality, the spiritual qualities, if you like, of who they really are. People comply all the time. People who are in codependent relationships comply all the time. And on one level, you can look at that and just think, oh, look how wonderful it is, how obedient they are. Obedience isn't that kind of quality. It's what's actually going on underneath the hood that counts. When we see the spiritual quality of this unnamed servant, we suddenly begin to understand where it's really at. Well, people can tick boxes all the time. Look at this. I have done this level of obedience. I've done this 10, 12, 15 today. Tick, tick, tick. I've done them all. I got up out of bed and did shacharit. All that tells me is the alarm went off and you got out of bed and did shacharit. If I really want to know who you are, I've got to get to know you. See what's happening in your life. To hear what you say when you think no one's listening. To look at your decisions that you make when dealing with people. That's where you really begin to see what is going on in someone's life. And it's interesting and fascinating when we look at this, scroll forward through time to the first century with Yeshua's Judaism, the Messianic Judaism, the Judaism we read of in the Messianic writings that went on to break the mould in the first century of what Judaism is, was and should be. It's interesting because so often what Yeshua does when he's teaching, yes, through the parables and everything else, is he reaches back almost to this earlier nascent stage in Judaism where it's the qualities, the spiritual qualities which come out of a man that frame and hallmark that person's life, not just mere obedience, that Yeshua reaches back to when he's talking about the quality of our spiritual walk with him. And so, of course, we move on to the parable of the Good Samaritan in all of this. It's a wonderful, beautiful parable. But before I jump into that, I'm just going to give you a little bit of background, something else which is going on before we even get to that point. The parables, in so many ways, they're not about observance. They're not about mere observance. They're not about just doing the commandments. They're not just about this. You read the parables. And we'll have to say, not just from Yeshua, but many other of the parables that were around in the first century too, the historic Jewish parables, are looking at spiritual qualities in people all the time. So let's look at this for a second, the so-called Good Samaritan. Take a step back. Go back a chapter in all of this. Because as in all stories, there's a backstory. There's something else which you need to understand that is going on. Going back into the Besorah of Lucas into chapter 9 here. And I'm going to pick up from 51. Now it came to pass, when the time had come for him to be received up, that he steadfastly set his face, as it were, as flint, to go to Jerusalem. He sent messengers before him. And as they went, they entered a village of the Samaritans to prepare for him. But they did not receive him, because his face was set for his journey to Jerusalem. And when his Talmudim, James, Yochanan, Yaakov, saw this, they said, Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, just as Elijah did? Yay! Let's have fireworks! But he turned and rebuked them. He said, you do not know what manner of spirit you are of. For the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. And so they went on to another village. It's fascinating. Pre-practice, as it were, for the parable of the Good Samaritan is going before our eyes today. The context in all of this. Let's step back for one moment. We all know the parable of the Good Samaritan. How many of you are aware that it was the Samaritans who were the heretical side of the family? You know, the ones we don't talk to. We have nothing to do with them. They've split off from us. Judeans avoided, if at all possible, to even walk through the northern land. In fact, Josephus recalls for us, so dire was the attitude in the south of Israel at that point, to avoid the Samaritans, they would cross over the Jordan, go up the other side of the Kinneret, if they were going to the Galilee. They didn't even want to go anywhere near the Samaritans. And it's interesting because as we read in the Besorah here, we suddenly discover, here is Yeshua, slam bang, in the middle of Samaria. But it says here, Yeshua's face was set for Jerusalem, and so the Samaritans rejected Yeshua. It's a fascinating little comment as well, just giving the background of all of this. His face was set for Jerusalem. The people there knew Yeshua was going to Jerusalem. That is why they rejected him. Why? Because the Samaritans did not accept Jerusalem to be the capital of the land, of the nation. They saw Yeshua as a Judean. And so they did not receive him. They wanted nothing to do with this man. Not because they rejected his teaching. Because as we saw, as Lenka was preaching as well, with the Samaritan woman, she runs back into the city and says, this is the Mashiach, come and hear. It wasn't so much they rejected his teaching, they rejected what they thought he represented. Jerusalem, the Judeans. Not an entirely unusual situation. Entirely predictable, actually. In fact, even better, Yeshua's own followers reacted entirely predictably at that point. Let's bring judgment down on them. Let's bring fire down from heaven. Let's just destroy these people because we hate them, right? Let's just remove them from the planet. And as Yeshua says, you do not know who you are talking about. You do not know what spirit that you talk. He rejected them completely. He says, no, that is not the right way that we deal with these people. But these were the people, the enemies of Israel. His understanding of Torah is in error. And he still chooses to not bring harm on them. Did you hear that? The enemies of Israel perceived As Yeshua would have seen it, the Samaritans who were in error of their understanding of the Torah, not only does he understand they're in error, but suddenly he is moving through their countryside, visiting their villages, receiving food from the Samaritan woman. Hello, as Lenka was saying last week. The enemies of our people. And at that moment when Yeshua's father saying, you know what, Lord, we'll deal with this fire, please. Sorted. Yeshua refuses. He refuses and chooses to not bring harm upon them. He doesn't wish them harm. He doesn't cause harm to them. In fact, from Yeshua's own understanding of all of this, to act in such a way with your enemies would be to operate in a different spirit rather than the Holy Spirit, which is what he says we should operate in. His words, not mine. When we stand back in judgment upon those who we think deserve to have their bodies blistered by the fire from heaven, Yeshua's view of that is, it's a different spirit. It is not the holy variety. But we love to do this, don't we? People, we're living in a world right now where we perceive our enemies to be such that fire should descend upon them from heaven and destroy them. Our countries, our nations so divided. Families divided, communities divided. Hatred is rife. I suggest it's not a situation unlike what we see here between the Judeans in the south and the Samaritans in the north. That mutual hatred and the sense of wanting to destroy each other, each one proclaiming to be the truth. And Yeshua says, no, we will not bring harm. We will not wish harm, nor will we cause harm to those that we disagree with. And I don't think we understand today the level of shock this statement would have caused. It's the same level of shock the parable of the Good Samaritan caused. In fact, I think it's more than shock. I think I can imagine when Yeshua brought that parable of the Good Samaritan, there would have been outrage as a response. The Good Samaritan? They're all going to hell, aren't they? What do you mean the Good Samaritan? They can't do anything good. They're on the wrong track. How can they do good? Outrage, I would suggest, was the response to this parable. And that it should be taught by Yeshua seems to be even more outrageous. And we just read this because we know the parable so well. And we forget the setting that it is in. He was the neighbour? But hang on, whoa. The Levite. Huh? The Cohen. They're the good guys. And Yeshua says, no, they're not. No, they're not. I'm not going to read the parable to you again. We've just read it. You know exactly what it says. You know it off by heart, by sure. The Samaritans, the outcasts, the untouchables, the spiritual lepers who had undermined and ruined the faith, people who could do no good even if they tried. That's the one who's the hero of the parable. We want to avoid these people. You know, let's add the Samaritans to the list of the tax collectors and the sinners and the women of ill repute that we want to avoid. Oh, of course Yeshua didn't avoid them, did he? Either. He sat with the tax collectors and the sinners and the women of ill repute. He wasn't scared by their lives. He wasn't put off by the fact they were unclean. In fact, Yeshua understood that his very existence and his mission here was to reach those people who so many others thought were beyond reach. The ones at the rank and file didn't want to go near, didn't want to sit next to, who we thought could do no good if they tried. These are the ones that the Lord reached out to. Yeshua could have avoided from going and seeing the Samaritan woman. He chose not to. He could have avoided walking through Samaria to go to Jerusalem, but he chose not to. He decided to go to that well at that time to speak to a woman of the others. He decided to walk through these villages even knowing that they would reject him. He decided to do this and interact with these people. Truly, his contact list was decidedly dodgy to most righteous people. Or was it? Now, why did Yeshua behave in this way? What is it? He understood the Torah. He knew how wrong they all were up in the north. Why did he even bother? Why did he take the time? Why did he bother to connect with people who were beyond social righteous acceptability? Why did he even bother? He should have stuck with his nice little cozy clique in Jerusalem. The Levites, the Kohens, having nice comfortable discussions about Torah day in, day out. That's what he should have done. He was a righteous man. And yet he eschews such company to go and sit with the people that others would reject and despise and hate, who others would be building campaigns of hatred against to cause harm, to wish them harm in their downfall. Remember Yeshua's response to such people who take that line? You're speaking in a spirit, so I give you the exact words here. You do not know what manner of spirit you are of. And we respond with people in that way. Why? Because Yeshua came not to destroy men's lives, but to save them. He didn't come to call down fire on people's lives. And we know in this world right now, where this has become a common hobby to desire fire to fall on people's lives, where we're so divided, so full of hatred, vitriol and bile, that we have forgotten in which kingdom we actually truly live and function. And it's in this parable of this Samaritan man. Did you notice, by the way, as well, an unnamed man again? We don't know who he was, even if he was a real character, or whether it was just a story, or whether it was something Yeshua had even seen, because he sees everything. But an unnamed man goes on to demonstrate something of the spiritual qualities we are talking about here this morning. He's vital to our understanding of what Judaism is all about. Yeshua is making it clear that this Samaritan man, an enemy of our people, he reached way beyond the mere level of observance of Torah to connect with the spirit and the essence of what Torah is all about. Or shall we say, Yeshua's Torah, his Judaism. Because I want to give the Levite and the priest a pass this morning. In some way. They walked by and ignored the apparent corpse. In fact, neither of them was sinning in so doing. You know what? There is no command to bury a dead body found in public. They walked, they looked. Dead man on the side of the road, bleeding. Levite and Cohen looked at this and thought, I'm under no obligation. Kept walking. In fact, it was in the later 2nd century that the Mishnah testimony declares that one must become unclean by burying an abandoned corpse. But in the 1st century, according to the evidence of this parable, that was not the case. If it was the case, the Levite and the Cohen would have buried the body. But they didn't. Because they weren't required to. It wasn't a sin in that sense. So what's going on in this parable? It's fascinating when you look at it. Because the Levite and the priest, they looked at this situation, they looked at their own sense of cleanness in all of this, they realized that it wasn't an obligation, they kept moving. But the Samaritan didn't. So I don't want to be harsh on the Levite and the priest to come in here. We can't do that. They weren't acting out of character particularly. This is what one would have expected. And I think this begins to get to the nub of the issue of the spiritual qualities that Yeshua is really focusing on here. Because it was the Samaritan who stopped. And that being said, let's be clear here. The scriptures say the man was beaten within a hair of his life. He was, as it says, half dead. But you know what? He wasn't dead, was he? He wasn't dead. Oh, he looked like he was dead to the casual observer who kept moving because they had somewhere to be. But this is where we begin to understand he wasn't a corpse. And we're told that this man, this half-dead man, looked like he was a corpse, but it's the Samaritan man who actually bothered to come near, and at that point he discovered that the person was still alive. What was it that spoke to this man to even bother to check whether it was a corpse? You know what that was? Compassion. Compassion. The text says he had compassion on him. And so he began to tend him back to health. And this is from a man who had no wish to bless the Jewish people, the Judeans from the south, his spiritual enemies, who in normal days would just ignore each other or worse. This is from someone who is one of our enemies, who had the compassion in him to override how he felt about people, draw close anyway, check, because he understood what compassion was all about. Compassion is a Torah quality. And the Samaritan man illustrated it for us here. He becomes the archetypical neighbor at this point. The outsider who we didn't expect righteousness from this man and yet did it anyway. The Samaritan and the corpse go on to become linked by neighborliness. At this point, what do we learn from all of this? This is more than just what you might think of Torah going on in this parable today. Something which you can reach back through history to this unnamed servant. There's more than just obedience, more than just obeying commandments, being told what to do. There's something more going on in all of this. The fact that he was a Samaritan was most certainly not lost on Yeshua's followers. Why would he do this? Yeshua breaks the mold again, shatters our conceptions of what we understand by Torah, and throws them into the bin. For Yeshua, the spiritual qualities of this Samaritan passerby are the most important bits for us. And this, bearing in mind the context of it all, where you've got someone who is righteous in his Torah lifestyle, comes up to Yeshua to test him and says, "How can I get eternal life?" This man knows. He knows. You keep the Torah, right? He knows how you get eternal life. He's testing Yeshua to see if he can trip him up in some way to make him go against what the Torah is saying. And Yeshua brilliantly answers him with this parable. He says, okay, you want to argue on a point of technicality of who's a neighbor? You want a religious debate about this? I'll show you what's really going on here, he says. This man, this Samaritan man, went beyond the mere letter of the Torah. And again, remember, the others weren't technically wrong in passing by. But the Samaritan embraced not just the letter of the Torah, he embraced the spirit of the Torah too. Arguably, we have to be honest, this is what the later Mishnah did too under Hillel's guidance. It too was pointing on what the spirit of the Torah was really all about. You don't just leave someone lying on the side of the road, regardless of what the Torah commands are. But what we can draw down from all of this, what is so important for us, is that we can so often argue that we are technically correct in our approach to the mitzvot and yet miss the actual threshold of righteousness by a mile. And we can stand in our own self-righteousness. We can stand in our hatred of other people and those we oppose, and we don't want this and we don't want that. And yet in doing so, we can actually miss the real threshold of righteousness by a mile. Just put this in the bigger context, if you will, for a second. Consider Yeshua's rant against some amongst the Prushim who were tithing dill and mint. And they should have been. Yeshua accepted this. He said, "You're right to do this in your observance." And yet, he said, they neglected the weightier matters of the Torah to show justice, mercy, compassion, faith. So Yeshua's view of the Torah, as exemplified by the Samaritan, who's one of our enemies, is to go way beyond the mere letter of all of this and say it's about what's in your heart, what you bring out of this, the compassion the love, your weightier matters, faith, mercy, justice, kindness, goodness, all of these are the Torah. And yet so often, spiritual small-mindedness causes us to focus on a very narrow view of righteousness and go on to miss the bigger picture. People who separated themselves from the unclean or the sinners or the tax collectors were well, quite well within their rights on one level, according to the letter of Torah, to act in that way. Just throw in a bit of old-fashioned bigotry and discrimination on top as well, but away you go. The fact that Yeshua sat with these people, bringing upon himself the approbation of the people around him who judged him for behaving in that manner, showed that Yeshua saw the deeper spirit of the Torah, saw and understood what is actually the real essence of what Torah is all about. As he says, I didn't come to judge but to save. I did not come to destroy but to save people, he says. It's the self-righteous who want to destroy. It's the self-righteous who want to judge. The self-righteous who want to stand on parade because they're getting it right all the time. But such an attitude is spiritual small-mindedness. God is our judge, and in that alone we shall trust. That's why I find it interesting, even when Russia all in the Masonic writing discussing spiritual leadership, isn't it interesting when he gives those tables of what a leader should be? It doesn't say things like they should be kosher and keep Shabbat and they should separate their meat and milk and they should do this and do that and do this and do the other. What is it that Shaul even focuses upon there? He's not so focused upon how Torah observant leaders are within communities or should be. He really focuses on the fruit of their character and their personality and their inner nature. It's the quality of a person you need to look at. Because we're all sinners. And frankly, if that's the level that we want to judge people and their appropriateness for leadership, then frankly, no one should be in leadership. No one. Because there is no one who is perfect before God. It's the fruit of their character, the fruit of the spirit in a person's life, their personality, how Yeshua is manifesting himself in that person, their inner nature, how they live, how they behave, what they say, what they think, how they act in different situations, just like the Samaritan man here, that shows the quality of a person, of their inner life. The self-righteous, of course, will hate this, as they want a leader who ticks all the boxes. And yet this superficial approach only undermines the real foundations of what Torah, righteousness and Judaism is all about. Why do I say that? Because I can absolutely guarantee you, someone who will want to be a rabbi will have got his observance just perfect. Because that's what he thinks that we will be judging by. But that's not what the scriptures say. Someone who thinks they've got their life absolutely off to a T, who thinks they're leading that perfect spiritual life before the Lord and are not sinning in any way, shape or form, should be nowhere near the leadership. Yes, the self-righteous will hate this, but that isn't what the scriptures say. Step back for a moment in our own day and age. How people copy and imitate righteousness in a superficial way. We see it in all kinds of realms. People do this when they go for job interviews. They present a picture of themselves on that day and the people go, wow, what an amazing person. Only 2 months later do they realize they've employed the wrong one. It happens again and again. I've known it even in my own professional career, where people who should certainly not have been in the position have been promoted to it because the people who wanted to get rid of them wrote them an excellent recommendation letter. People do this. It's not about that. It's who they are as a person, those inner qualities. And it's why the Messianic writings talk about the fruit of the Spirit. Don't just look at the superficial things that someone does, whether it's in the spiritual realm, the political realm, in the secular realm. You know, people do this. Don't just look at what people do. People can do things for all kinds of motives. Look at what they are. Look at their spiritual life. Look at who they are. Look at what's going on inside them. Quasi, as Rav Shaul would say, look for the fruit of the Spirit in their lives. I say this because I've despaired in the last few weeks of seeing believers following people who frankly should not have their loyalty, because of the actual quality of their lives is dire, and yet people slavishly follow. And people post things on their internet feeds, on their Facebook feeds, that are a disgrace and a shame that it should even be seen in public. And these are believers. But even then I'm saying, don't just look at what they post. Think about why they're posting it. What's going on in their lives? Spiritual qualities is what we need to be looking at here. Because you know what? People can fake superficial righteousness. You cannot fake the fruit of the Spirit. Because you either have the Spirit or you do not. And if you do, then you will be exhibiting the Spirit of that fruit, the fruit of that Spirit. Now, sometimes people would say to me, and have said to me in the past, Rabbi so-and-so gave their life to the Lord. And my response is always, come back and speak about that person in a year. Then I'll know whether they gave their life to the Lord. Oh, but they said the words. They said the prayer. Saying the prayer is the easiest thing in the world. People say the prayers and make people happy. We will know whether that person is truly born again, because in a year's time we'll begin to see the fruit of the Spirit manifesting in that person's life. Or even 6 months' time, whatever time. It's the fruit of the Spirit that gives you the proof of the pudding. Words are cheap, words are easy. Even acts can be cheap and easy to imitate. Things of mere observance or tokenistic gestures of apparent righteousness. The Samaritan it was who went beyond that and approached the corpse to see what could be done. I want to conclude this morning. The passage that you kind of would know that I'm going to conclude with, really, in Galatians, of course. The only passage that we could conclude with. But I want to read this to you. This comes from the letter to the Jewish community in Galatians chapter 5, starting from verse 22-23. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such there is no law. Again, I'm going to say it. Do you notice it says, the fruit of the Spirit is not keeping Shabbat, running a kosher kitchen, making sure you do all your high holy days right. And. It could easily have said that. But it doesn't. Rav Shaul gets to the nub of the issue here. The fruit of the Spirit in us is the testimony of a changed character and personality, a change in your nature, that you now live love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness and self-control. That's what you look for in a person's life. And nothing else. We're expecting you to be Jewish and to be living a Jewish life. But you know what? It's easy to fake that on paper. What you're really looking for the Spirit to work is the fruit of these things in someone's life. That's what we're looking for. And I want to pick up out of all of that list just one. Just one. You know what that one is in the face of what we're dealing with in this world right now? Gentleness. Gentleness. If Rav Shaul was standing here looking at all of this, to believers, to us as Messianic Jews, I think he would say, be gentle with one another. You heard it in our Shacharit this week, I think it was Debbie who quoted from Philippians. Be gentle with one another. This world is not being gentle on each other right now. Where's the kindness? Where's the chesed? This world needs kindness and gentleness. People, be kind to each other. Be gentle to each other. If there's one thing I'll leave you with from this morning, it's that. Be gentle with each other. We need it. Yes, even your opponents, according to Yeshua, who you would gladly walk by on the other side. It's about revealing the true spiritual qualities of our life in Torah to this dark, lost and confused world. It goes way beyond mere observance, way beyond box ticking. Yes, we're meant to be observant, keep the mitzvot, of course, I take that as read. But it's more than that. It's these spiritual qualities, the spiritual fruit that Shaul says we should be demonstrating and exhibiting in our lives. When someone goes above and beyond and does the extra mile, beyond the mere observance, to the core of true spiritual righteousness. Yes, keep the mitzvot, but don't think your job is done once you tick the list. People, be kind to each other. Be gentle to each other. For against such, there is no law. Amen.